This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Hi, I'm Mark from Annandale, New Jersey.
I'm Chris Nelson from South Dakota.
I'm Jen from Oakland.
The Sound of Young America is an independent production
supported by listeners like me.
If you'd like to support the show like I did, visit MaximumFun.org and click on Donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, it's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the program, Nick Hornby, is an acclaimed novelist whose many books include, we're talking about High Fidelity. We're looking at About a Boy. We're talking about a slam, about a skateboarding teen. We're talking about A Long Way Down, about a group of people who are committing suicide. We're talking about, most recently, the book Juliet Naked, which follows three characters, an aging singer-songwriter who's willfully excluded himself from the music business for 20 years or so, his biggest fan and the leader of his internet fan community, and his biggest fan's wife, who's a little bit perplexed by the whole thing. He's also the screenwriter behind the just-released film An Education, which follows a teenage girl in the early 1960s in England as she dates a much older and apparently much more sophisticated gentleman. Nick Hornby, it's great to have you back on The Sound of Young America.
It's lovely to be here. You've been reading up on me.
You know what? Here's what I do, Nick. Every time a guest is coming on the program, I try and learn a little bit about them so that the interview will be better.
But this doesn't happen in the rest of America.
Have you had bad experiences thus far? People know who you are. They remember Jack Black's star-making turn in the film High Fidelity.
Sometimes they don't connect it with me.
You are Jack Black,
I
right?
I am Jack Black.
It's a twofer, because you wrote those great books, and you do all those funny, like, turns and dances.
Exactly.
It is great to have you back here on the show, and I really enjoyed this new book. You know, it features things that we've come to expect from your oeuvre, such as, you know, record nerds and music and stuff like that. But it also features other things that we've less come to expect, like getting old.
Yes, that seems to be happening.
Your protagonist, Tucker Crowe, or one of your triumvirate of protagonists, Tucker Crowe, is this singer-songwriter who is kind of looking at towards the end of his life. I mean, not, you know, the death years, but he's looking at himself in his slow decline and coming to terms with the fact that he's sort of an old dude. What moved you to write about that part of life?
Well, I think because I'm an old dude.
Not quite.
Yeah, well, I turned 50. I think when you turn 50, you stop making the joke that you're getting old. You know, when you do it when you're 20 and 30 and 40, and you say, oh, I'm getting old. And then 50, you don't make that joke anymore because it's actually just true. And I would say that 50 is the first birthday I've had where I realized that I am actually going to get old and die.
Really?
Where I felt it in my bones.
Yeah. What did you feel?
I thought, oh dear. yeah, so, you know, some of that was in there. There is a kind of melancholy. It's a book about the past in lots of ways, that these characters, Annie and Duncan, Duncan's the nerdy one. They live in this seaside town that's kind of the past because nobody goes to English seaside towns anymore, especially in the northern half of the country. Everyone goes to Spain for £30 instead. And Annie works in a museum, and Tucker doesn't have a career anymore. His career is in the past, and Duncan's focusing on what happened to Tucker 20 years ago. So that's partly what the book's about, I think, the past and regret.
Well, my wife and I watched An Education earlier today, and she had just she read the book as well. And she said to me, well, you could tell Nick Hornby was involved. And I was like, why is that? And she said, oh, you know, like some people are in it and they're sort of dissatisfied with what's going on. And They go through a big, long thing. She did not mean any of this pejoratively, and I want to make that clear.
That's fine.
They go through a big, long thing, have a lot of adventures, and the biggest thing that they learn is how to be comfortable with what they were rather than how to be a new thing.
Yes. Well, I would say that's kind of my subject, and it's quite a good subject, I think, because... It seems to me there's too much in the culture that teaches us how to be a new thing. And that's what most books are about. And they have messages. And the message is that you can be a whole brand new you. And I think that's probably particularly true of America. And I don't really believe that. And I think that the best we can do is make peace with ourselves and who we are and what we've got.
Was that ever hard for you to do?
To make peace with myself and what I was. It's difficult to answer because I wouldn't have been able to make peace with myself if I hadn't been able to write or if I hadn't been able to make a living as a writer. I think I would have been pretty dissatisfied. And so once I got published, it was pretty easy to make peace with myself because that was really the ambition, I think, was to be able to support myself through writing.
Sometimes I have like nightmares about the protagonist of High Fidelity who's struggling with this conflict within himself, which is essentially, is he going to be a guy who makes things or a guy who like listens to things that other people made and categorizes them? And I wonder if you ever had to deal with that in your life, if you ever imagined yourself as a more successful appreciator than creator?
Well, I never really settled for that. There was a time when I was doing a lot of criticism and, you know, of books and music and things like that. And I wasn't quite satisfied with that. I wanted to do something that was more creative. But I think it's a pretty good life being an appreciator. And I wouldn't ever give it up because that's a part of my work still, you know, writing about books and writing about being a fan of stuff.
What's the relationship between those two, between creating something out of whole cloth and also having so much of yourself dedicated to, like, you know, the first time you came over, you were so excited to see Swamp Dog.
Yes, that's right.
Which is, you know, Swamp's a super cool guy and everything, but like, it's like something you have to be an appreciator to get into.
Yes, I suppose so. You're saying not everyone's come
As it turns out, yeah. I mean, granted, like you'll hear, sure, on the local top 40 station here in Los Angeles, Swamp is getting 15, 20, 25 spins a week, but he's no I've Got a Feeling by the Black Eyed Peas.
Yeah, well, I think the relationship between the one and the other is that I can't do one without the other. A lot of stuff's got to go in before it comes out. And certainly, you know, music gets converted into words somehow. I listen to it, you know, on the way to work. I listen to it all the time when I'm writing a novel. And I have to read and I have to watch movies. And this stuff is really important fuel to me.
What went into Juliet Naked?
Juliet Naked, there's a lot of things, actually. I'll speed list it for you. A profile of Sly Stone in a magazine about 3 or 4 years ago in which the journalist lured Sly Stone out for an interview. My six-year-old son, who developed a sudden and very upsetting for a time fear of death. The book What Good Are the Arts by Professor John Carey, where he argues that if somebody says something's a work of art, then it is a work of art. There's no other argument that holds water. Having readers, putting books out there and having people respond to them. A book I started before that was pretty much like another book I'd written before and I couldn't get going with, partly because I was bored. So I thought, I want to write about different people, maybe older people. I want to write in the third person and I want to set it outside my home turf. You know, hundreds of things.
Let's talk about a couple of those things that you just speed listed. I wasn't taking notes, so I'll probably mess it up. But let's start with Sly Stone. I remember when Sly Stone first came out in public and hadn't spoken publicly in, since the mid-'80s. And what was it that was so interesting to you about that, besides just the fact that, you know, Sly Stone made a lot of really amazing records?
Well, I think what was interesting to me about the piece was that the journalist was a fan, and his excitement at seeing this guy for the first time, you know, being the first to see him for the first time in 10 or 12 years, and he turns up on his great big motorbike and says crazy things. That had a real kind of narrative power to it, I think, that I stored away and thought, actually, you know, of course, a recluse who is missing for the first part and then comes back later on. You're bound, if you do it right, you're bound as a reader to get a kick out of that, I think.
It's interesting. I mean, the different people have different reasons for disappearing. I mean, I've had in the past couple of years on my show two people who whose music I really care about, who had been gone from the music industry for a really long time. I interviewed Betty Davis, who was a funk musician in the 1970s, yep, and married to Miles Davis. And she has literally been a recluse for 20 years or so. And in the interview related to me like someone who'd been a recluse for 20 years. And I interviewed Bill Withers, who has also been retired for 20 years, outside of writing a couple songs for other people here and there. And he was almost the opposite. Like he had just left, and he had left to do something else with his life. And they both felt like, you know, music industry had taken a lot out of them.
Yeah.
But he, one had kind of disappeared into herself and one had decided to go do something else. Tucker is kind of a muddled mix. He's sort of lost his way as much as anything else.
Yes, I think one of the big problems for him is that he's made this album that everyone, all his fans, regard as a work of great genius called Juliet, and you know, which is a kind of Blood on the Tracks.
Hear my dear,
cry of pain about a breakup, and part of his trouble is that he thinks it's phony. He thinks it's inauthentic. I don't want to give too much away, but you know, there are reasons for this. And he can't take what he reads about Juliet because it doesn't chime with what he feels about Juliet, and he didn't know where to go after he'd made it, which I kind of understand and completely accept as a reason for not making any more music. He's also a drinker, and you know, he has 5 kids by 4 different women and failed relationships with pretty much all of them apart from the youngest boy.
It must be a relief for you when you're spending all this time thinking about it to realize that you don't have quite the same burden of direct personal expression that a contemporary singer-songwriter does in your novels. You can make something up and it's totally allowed.
Yes, and I think, you know, there is always some kind of autobiographical relationship with one's own fiction because, you know, that's why you have an interest in whatever it is in the first place. There is something in you, in your upbringing or your makeup, that has produced this work. And so if you dig around, you can find what it is. And it's not always as direct as people think it is. But, yeah, that sort of raw cry of pain stuff, I often think how odd that must be. You know, if you write this song about some woman who destroyed you and 25 years later you're still playing it, you have no idea where the woman is, you can't remember how you felt about her in the first place, but you're still singing the song. I think that's kind of an odd relationship with a piece of art. It's harder for singer-songwriters because it's an active relationship. I don't, you know, when I see Springsteen and he sings, you know, "Does this bus stop at 82nd Street" off the first album, I don't know what that's like for a 60-year-old man to sing that.
Another one of the primary characters in Juliet Naked is this woman named Annie who lives in a sort of seaside town that's sort of like, at one point it's compared to, you compare it to one of the towns in an early Springsteen record.
Well, Tucker thinks of that, but yes.
It's sort of an English seaside town that's like slightly abandoned and somewhat desultory.
Yes.
At least in her eyes. What made you think of someone who's in a place like that and feels trapped in a place like that?
Well, partly I wanted to write about isolation, and it's harder to write about isolation if somebody lives in a city. I mean, if someone's isolated in the middle of London, then they're a different kind of person. Annie's isolated culturally. She doesn't know too many people like her in this small seaside town. There's no bookstore in this town. And she and Duncan are kind of huddled together for warmth a little bit. They know that, or they think they know, that if they split up, they're not going to find any like-minded souls. So it's a kind of marriage of convenience. And also, you know, I wanted Duncan to be away from other fans of Tucker Crowe. And again, it's kind of easier to meet up with someone in a city. You know, it seemed to me that what had changed since High Fidelity is the way that we consume music. Everything's changed since 1995 when that book was published. People don't go out to find music anymore. And Duncan wouldn't have had anyone to talk to. He might have, you know, had a drink with someone once a year and they could indulge in their Tucker Crowe fetish. But now you can just talk every day, all day, to somebody who's exactly like you. And I'm not altogether sure that's a good thing.
It's an interesting, in the context of isolation, that they're both living together to find somebody else who likes to watch The Wire, and which, you know, I can relate to that. But at the same time, he's living this whole other, like, really complicated life online that she can only kind of look at a little bit confused.
Yes, and I think that's kind of what's happening a lot. You know, all those Dylan guys talk to each other all the time. I think there are artists who attract those kinds of people. I was thinking about that a lot, actually, when I was conceiving the book and while I was writing it, that you have to be kind of oblique in some way, I think, to have the real diehard head cases pouring over your every word. I'm not sure that Springsteen gets that, for example. He's probably the closest I come to being a completist. But I think that when you hear Springsteen, you understand what you're listening to. I don't think anyone's really confused about a Springsteen record. But Dylan, there's nothing he can say which seems direct and which doesn't apparently yield something up under close analysis. And so, you know, I wanted Tucker Crowe to be more that kind of guy, I guess.
Did you discover anything thematically in writing the book that you weren't planning on going in?
I think that there was much more about regret than I probably intended when I started.
Why's that?
Well, I guess I just started to see how regretful the characters were, and it wasn't something, you know, it wasn't as though I planned the novel saying I'm going to write a book about regret, so these people have to be regretful. It just kind of happened with the circumstance and the function of the book that was what I found myself thinking most about on their behalf, as it were.
There are these two guys in the book, peripheral characters, who are really passionate about Northern Soul, which is, I guess you should explain for American listeners who don't know what that is, what that is.
I could never believe when I discovered Northern Soul that it actually did refer to the north of England.
Because obviously, I always thought it just meant like Detroit,
yeah, exactly,
and Chicago, but no.
Yeah, because, you know, you just think, well, Southern Soul, we know where that comes
from.
Yeah,
but Northern, from Memphis.
Northern Soul was really the towns in England like Wigan and sort of northern industrial towns where they, for some reason, developed a passion for a sort of sub-Motown music. It was really at its heyday at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s. And, you know, some Motown songs are regarded as Northern Soul classics, but part of the point of the songs are their obscurity. That if everyone's heard of it, then it can't really be a Northern Soul song because you've got to be able to hunt these 45s down. And these guys, they're very athletic dancers, and they wear their sort of Fred Perry shirts and their Adidas trainers, and they take talcum powder to dance halls, and they dust the floor so that it's not too slippy. And they're really, really serious about the dancing and the music. But the music's sort of not the very best, really. And there are a couple of these guys. And again, it's something that's kind of over, even though people still do it.
It's interesting. These guys have this wholehearted passion for doing this. And Annie goes out, and she's completely blissfully unaware of this phenomenon, you know, which is, as you mentioned, a pretty well-faded phenomenon at this point. And she's really, like, amazed by their commitment to it. It's also an interesting kind of nerdiness because it's a kind of nerdiness where it's actually about physicality and actually relating to other people.
Yeah, the dancing is you know, I think Annie describes it somewhere between Kung Fu and Cossack. You know, there's some odd moves that go on. It's quite male, as far as I can tell, as well. There was a kind of relationship to mods, kind of relationship to football hooliganism. And when Annie discovers, when she hears about it, she thinks it's going to be the key to living in this city, that it's what the city is famous for, and that once she walks through this door, she's going to walk into this throng of people, and suddenly she will feel that she's living in the present, the town is living in the present, and there's something to be kind of proud of and engaged in. But of course, when she pays her money and goes in, there's no one there either, and it's all a bit tragic.
There's still something kind of honorable about it, though.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think Sarah Vowell says, you know, that the best relationships she's made are with people who care too much about certain things, whether it's politics or, you know, music or books or, you know, sport as well in my case. And I don't really trust people who don't care too much about things.
Let me ask you this question,
though.
That was
the significance of Swamp Dog. When I walked into this, it was, I thought you were a serious person. I didn't know who you were the first time I came in. But I thought,
you saw that autograph photo of a man who once made an album cover of him in his underpants riding a rat, a giant rat. You said, "This is a serious man.
This is a serious man. This is a man with a moral center."
I bet this is a guy who's got a lot of Proust on his bookshelf.
But I did take it as an indication of good things, not because necessarily I share your taste, but simply because you clearly care about something that not everybody cares about.
Let me ask you this question, though. It seems like it seems like this kind of caring about, and it's reflected in this book, is much more of a dude thing than it is a lady thing.
Well, it would appear to be that way. I mean, I think we all know that women do have obsessional moments, but it quite often is about other people, about friends and sometimes men. And, you know, they remember people's birthdays and they work really hard to keep relationships going. Whereas, you know, a lot of men I know, you know, if someone moves 3 blocks down the street, then that's it. It's over, because you don't go to the same bar anymore. So how can you possibly stay in touch? So I think that women tend to put more energy into maybe more... I was going to say healthy areas of life, but I don't know if that is the case.
How do you think that's, I mean, you're a guy with a lot of passion. How has that affected your life?
Well, I turned it into fun and profit for a start, with certainly the first two books. I think, you know, you go on journeys with these things. I for a long time, I think football meant way too much and would cast a shadow over weekends, weeks, months sometimes. No, seriously, you know, like a whole summer could be ruined if it all went wrong in May, which is the end of our football season. I think that you can find yourself being really judgmental to people who, it would appear, don't care very much about things. You know, if they've got a couple of Phil Collins albums and a Celine Dion and that'll do them, there was a time when I would have judged them, you know, as human beings for that. I think that I've moved on.
There's a character, there's a townsperson in the book who hears that there's a big singer-songwriter in town and is like super disappointed it's not Billy Joel, if I remember
correctly. That's right, yeah. But then gets very excited when he finds out he's American, because as far as he can remember, there hasn't been an American visitor, so his nationality is of more significance than his job.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Nick Hornby, whose most recent book is called Juliet Naked. We'll be back in just a minute to talk with Nick about writing the film An Education. It's The Sound of Young America from PRI Public Radio International. Max FunCon is an annual convocation of awesome, hosted by me, Jesse Thorne, and MaximumFun.org. You can spend a weekend in beautiful Lake Arrowhead, California, enjoying classes and shows from some of our favorite past Sound of Young America guests. This year, we'll have Jonathan Colton, Casper Hauser, Maria Bamford, Mark Maron, Al Madrigal, Jimmy Pardo, Andrew W.K., and more. Registration for Max FunCon just opened, but beds go fast. Visit MaximumFun.org for more information and registration.
production of The Sound of Young America is underwritten in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
It's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the writer Nick Hornby. In addition to a new novel called Juliet Naked, he's also written the screenplay for a film in theaters now, An Education. An Education, as I mentioned, is a film about a 16-year-old girl, 16, 17-year-old girl. And that is something that's really, really far from like a 27-year-old guy who's acting like a 17-year-old guy, which is which to this point has been your hallmark. What did you relate to when you read the essay in Granta that the film was based upon, the sort of like 10 pages that it was?
Well, there are a couple of things. I think the first thing was, and I didn't know this at the time, but I saw as I'd worked on it over a period of years that I was starting to see it as actually a different version of Fever Pitch, which was, I was that suburban kid who was very frightened of being locked out of the city and looking for ways in and trying to join the mainstream of a kind of subcultural city life. And I found that for very little money, I could enter a football stadium and stand in the middle of it. And that was a big part of the appeal for me. For Jenny in the movie, this guy picks her up and literally drives her into the center of the city. And as a consequence, she's exposed to, art and music and food and theater and other countries. And I identify with that very strongly, the need to get access to that stuff. And I know what it was like in England. I was a little kid when this film takes place, but my town wasn't so different 10 or 15 years later. I had to go quite a long way to buy books and buy music that I actually wanted. Of course, that's something that's changed since.
I read an essay that the author of the original memoir piece wrote about the development of this film, and she said that she had a clause in her contract that she wouldn't change anything in the scripts as they were written by you. And she mentioned she was kind of surprised that you were going to be doing it since you're more known for Dudes. And but that she would give feedback at each stage. What was that process like for you to write a screenplay that, over the course of years and many iterations with this person who had lived a real experience that you were fictionalizing?
Well, I think the thing that was to my enormous advantage is that she's very smart. She's a smart writer, she's a smart journalist, and she understood that if it was ever going to be a movie, things had to be invented. I mean, there just wasn't enough in the original piece for a start to be faithful to this 10-page memoir. You had to invent friends, scenes, lines, everything. And so, she understood immediately that there was going to be invention happening. And
that's
she,
when you added the adolescent wizards.
Exactly. But she never, ever said, that didn't happen or my dad wasn't like that. She read with great interest, I think. And, we talked about it sometimes. I found her particularly helpful on period detail and she helped me to think about the time, and I ended up realizing that this was one of the last times in English history that English cool kids had a relationship with what we call the continent. After the Beatles, everything swiveled round this direction. Everyone wanted to see American movies and listen to American music and read American books. But Jenny, she's watching French New Wave films, she's listening to Juliet Greco, she wants to go to Paris, she's reading Camus. It was really a different cultural conversation. And, like Lynn told me that they all read French L at school, and that was like a really cool thing to do, was to hunt down L in French and all sit around looking at the fashion photos because it was all completely different. Stuff like that I thought was great and really helpful.
There's an amazing scene where the protagonist is taking orders for Chanel No. 5 when she's planning on a trip to Paris.
From her, from little kids at school, yeah. Well, we had currency restrictions in the 50s and early 60s, and it was really rare for people to go abroad. And I think, America was a wealthy country in the 1950s, and you think of all that rock and roll music and the imagery that accompanies it, and that really comes from affluence, the cars with the fins and, picking your girlfriend up and driving her off. Well, nobody had a car in England. No kid had a car, certainly. And you waited at the bus stop in the rain. So there was a kind of lack of identification, I think, with the cool kids, with American rock and roll. And it took the Beatles and the Stones to sort of interpret it and then send it back. And then it made a bit more sense. And, of course, we were getting more affluent anyway.
It must be scary as, you wrote the screenplay for the first version of Fever Pitch.
Yeah.
But it must be scary as a novelist who's used to having a sort of control over his work that you don't get in a screenplay situation, or at least having, at least being able to try and manage a direct relationship with the person who's reading it,
Yes, that's a good way of putting it, actually. It is. I wouldn't say it's scary, because part of the point of doing it for me is collaboration, and you're at the service of a director. That's what the script's for. It's not this thing in itself. It's pointless saying I'm not going to change a word, because that's a quick way of the movie never being made in the first place. If you feel like that, then you really should be writing books or maybe plays, because there's a more direct route from page to audience, I think, in the theatre.
One thing that I think the film has just some spectacular acting performances in it.
The cast is incredible.
It's really, and I'm not really the kind of guy who thinks or talks about that kind of thing a lot, but some really amazing performances. And one thing that I think is captured in the film very well is like 16-iness.
Right.
How do you write 16-iness, and when you write it, how do you figure out how to make it into something that actually shows up on the screen as 16-iness, especially when it's not just the kind where someone's just acting super bratty and dumb?
It feels much closer than perhaps it should. 16-iness, I think it's such an incredible time in one's life, because you are this blank piece of paper and people are scribbling all over you, and you kind of never really forget that, the intense relationships you have with albums, books, movies, people, girlfriends, and some of it feels quite fresh. I have a sister who's 2 years younger than me, and I think that came in pretty useful, thinking about her. And I used to teach, and you just use what you can. But, a lot of it's Carey as well. This is Carey Mulligan, the girl who plays Jenny. And she was 22 when we made the film. So, it was a lot fresher in her mind, I think. And there's really a lot in her performance. I joked with my wife years ago when we first started working on it, and we were talking about what a big part it was and how difficult it was going to be to cast. I said, you will never read this line in a review: that was a great movie, but that girl sucked. Because it would be literally impossible. You couldn't have a great movie with the girl sucking. She's in every single scene of the film, and her intelligence and restraint and taste and detail, I think, is phenomenal.
When you meet Peter Sarsgaard, I presume you've met Peter Sarsgaard in real life.
Yeah, I saw him last night.
Do you have this combination of feelings that you'd like to kiss him, be his best friend, and you're kind of afraid he's going to kill you?
If you would like me to have those feelings, Jesse.
I just feel like anytime I see the man, I want to be his best friend. I'm like weirdly attracted to him, and also I'm terrified of him.
Yeah, there was really too much detail in that in that account for it to be anything other than personal response, I think. So you let it all out.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for letting it all out on the Sound of Young America. It was great to have you on the show.
Great to be back again.
Nick Hornby's new book is called Juliet Naked. He also wrote the screenplay for the new film An Education, which is in theaters right now. That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I've been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our theme music provided to us by Dan Wally. In fact, all the music for the program provided to us by Dan Wally. Our editor in Chicago is Nick White. Our intern, Mariel Reyes. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org, and I hope you'll join us for Max FunCon in May of 2010. You can find more information on Max FunCon, which features lots of our favorite past Sound of Young America guests in an idyllic hunting lodge meets summer camp context on a lake here in Southern California at MaxFunCon.com, MaxFunCon.com. If you have thoughts about the show, you can always email me. My email address is Jesse, J-E-S-S-E, at MaximumFun.org. And you can just address it to me. People send these emails and say to whom it may concern or something. Basically, Nick works part-time on the show editing it, and besides that, it's just me, so I'm the one that gets your email, Jesse at MaximumFun.org. We'll see you next time right here on The Sound of Young America from PRI, Public Radio International.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Homes.com. Homes.com knows having the right agent can make or break your home search. That's why they provide home shoppers with an agent directory that gives you a detailed look at each agent's experience, like the number of closed sales in a specific neighborhood, average price range, and more. It lets you easily connect with all the agents in the area you're searching, so you can find the right agent with the right experience and ultimately the right home for you. Homes.com. We've done your homework. Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Online. Is your child asking questions on their homework you don't feel equipped to answer? IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. One subscription gets you everything. One site for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And NPR listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me. And I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on Black experiences. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.